Hello, everyone. Welcome to a very special episode of Uncanny Treks. We're going to try and keep it short. That way it'll be special. It might be one of the worst episodes we ever do, but it's going to be me, Bob, and Cascadia talking to that guy, Matt, in the Southland about the cinematic masterpiece that was Venom 3.
Venom 3, Bob. I watched Venom 1. I watched Venom 2, even though you told me not to watch it.
It was Madame Web.
Madame Web.
I made you promise to not watch Madame Web until I was dead, and then you went and you broke that solemn vow to me.
And guys, literally 2 weeks later, I broke the solemn vow, so that goes to show you how much I really put...
You didn't tell me till months later.
Oh, it dropped on streaming like pretty quick, and I was like, I got nothing to watch.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I only half saw Venom 2. It came out back during the pandemic, so I didn't get to it in the theaters in time. It didn't stick around theaters for very long, as I remember. And then I did watch it on the plane back to Georgia, but the audio wasn't working and was cutting in and out. So I like saw the whole thing, but I only heard maybe a half to three quarters of it.
Yeah, Woody Harrelson's portrayal of Carnage, not my favorite. But I didn't really have high expectations to begin with.
Counterpoint in that end credit scene in Venom 1, when I get out of here, and I will, there's going to be carnage. That was pretty amazing, I thought.
That was okay, Bob. Yes, the post credit scene was great. And with the stupid wig, too, that just made it even better. Yeah, that made it even better. But then the actual movie with him in it, I'm really, the relationship with him, between him and Shriek. I did watch Venom 2.
Okay, well, you didn't need to. It has all those smooth.
Well, that's great, because I like it when I can just jump right into films and need no context whatsoever in a trilogy of movies.
Yeah, in a trilogy. So Venom 3, The Last Dance. Matt, the most important thing, and I texted you this after I got out of the theater, the most important one line, one sentence description I can tell you about this is the director of this film, who is a woman, is a foot fetishist. And she apparently just wanted to film the Storm Area 51 meme.
Okay, so I'm just assuming there's lots of feet. Venom feet?
Yeah, there's a lot of feet. So Tom Hardy's always losing his shoes.
Okay.
And then he's getting worse shoes. Also, and he's walking around in the wilderness barefoot.
A lot of nasty feet.
A lot of nasty feet. There's a scene where a Vegas drunk pees on Tom Hardy's feet.
Wow, that's definitely something going on there.
And then later he nearly breaks his foot because Venom makes him play the slot machine, and Venom makes him play their last $20 and he loses. And then Venom makes him kick the slot machine in a rage and he says, "Ow, I nearly broke my foot."
Okay.
He also has to like walk through broken glass near the climax of the movie, barefoot.
Bob, I would have been sold had you said that he has to play the slot machine with his foot.
Oh, yeah, he doesn't. Also, the slot machine scene is really bad, really overdone and not funny. I didn't care for it.
Okay.
There's two lady scientists in this movie.
Okay.
And they're studying the symbiotes, and they're studying the symbiotes in Area 55, which is underneath Area 51. And there's a really weird scene that's fetishizing the lady scientist's shoes in Area 55 to the point where, like, the camera lingered on it so long that I thought it was going to be a plot point in the climax of the movie, but it wasn't.
It was a MacGuffin or something?
It was a gun on a mantelpiece in a play that you expect to go off Chekhov's gun style.
It was literally the shoe from, like, the prime Marvel Universe.
Well, speaking of the prime Marvel Universe, Matt, do you remember where Venom 2 left our hero? Venom and Eddie Brock, full scale, are transported to the MCU at the end.
Yes, okay, gotcha.
And so this movie, like, the first time we see Venom, he's drinking in a bar in Mexico, and he's arguing with the bartender who's explaining Thanos to him, although he doesn't use the word Thanos, but he's explaining Thanos to him, and Eddie is just like, no, I know what aliens are like. That's not what aliens are like. He's in the MCU. He's in the bar. And then he instantly gets transported back to his universe, the Sony Spider-Man universe. And then he talks to the same bartender who's the Sony version of the bartender, who's very different and much more passive. And that's all they do with Venom in the MCU. It's not even really a gag. It's just like, oh, we thought we were going to do one thing, but turns out we're going to do a different thing.
Wow, what a cop-out, man. I guess Wolverine, maybe, you know, Wolverine didn't do all that. Wolverine was cool with it. They flat out had TVA and everybody from Disney. I guess.
Well, when you put it like that, Matt, it makes me grateful for this movie for not having TVA.
Yeah, because that's what I'm saying. They had everything that you possibly want from the multiverse in Deadpool and Wolverine, but here I guess they were only allowed that little itty bitty piece.
Okay. Now, Matt, do you remember the video game when we were kids that was the sequel to Maximum Carnage?
Separation Anxiety.
Yes, yes.
Did you remember
Separation Anxiety? Do you remember Venom has, I think it's quintuplets in that video game?
Yeah, he has all these like little Venoms that he like throws around.
Do you remember who any of them are? Their names or anything?
Oh, God. One was Rage or something, right? Or Wild Child or some Orchid or what they...
These are all really good guesses. But
okay.
No, but they're very good guesses.
I know they're stupid.
So we actually saw the first one, the first of the five. We saw him in Venom 1. The villain, who I think it's Riz Ahmed, bonds with a symbiote.
Yes.
And that is a gray symbiote who is, they never say this, but he's meant to be Riot, who's one of Venom's five kids from Separation Anxiety.
Yes, I remember Riot. He was in the first, yes, I remember him.
Okay. And then there's another one, Scream, who's the mostly yellow one. She, I think, is usually the leader, but she, as far as I can tell, doesn't show up in any of the three movies. So Riot killed in the first one, Scream doesn't show up. But then we have three who do show up here. In Area 55, the symbiote studying lab under Area 51, we've got the brown symbiote Phage, we've got the green symbiote Lasher, and then we've got the purple symbiote Agony. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's awful. Oh, God.
And so what happens is they don't call the symbiote Riot in the first film. They don't call any of these symbiotes those names, but they are them. And in the climax of the movie, the symbiotes break out and they bond with different characters in the lab. This brown symbiote Phage bonds with a security guard, but then it's a minor thing and there's like a symbiote eating alien creature, and the symbiote eating alien creature just kills Phage. And then Green Lasher bonds with one of the two lady scientists, but then the symbiote eating Phage kills Lasher, although it doesn't kill the host, it just kills Lasher. Does that make sense?
Yeah, man, I pulled up a picture of all these characters just so I could remember, kind of get under. The CGI on this was not that great.
Maybe not so bad on screen. CGI never looks good in a still
image. I've seen better stuff in video games, but I'm trying to be ugly, but
it's fair.
It's weird. Fair.
So then the other lady scientist bonds with Agony, the purple one.
Yeah.
And interestingly, the symbiote Agony doesn't get killed. She survives. And so they probably, I don't think they're actually going to do this, but it is very interesting that they're setting up this character, Agony, to appear again in a future movie, potentially. So the actress who plays the female scientist who's studying the symbiotes, who bonds with Agony, she's Juno Temple. Do you know her at all?
Yes. I'm trying to think of what I've seen her in, though. You got a rundown on what she's been in, Bob?
The only thing I've seen her in is she's in the last season of Fargo, season 5. Did you watch that?
No, I didn't.
She plays the main character in Fargo season 5, and she's great. It's a great season of television. Love Fargo, one of my favorite shows. She's really good in that, this man. And I mean, it's not her fault. I'm not going to like condemn her. I'm sure there with the writing, there's just, what can you even do, right?
Right.
But she's awful. The movie switches between her in the Area 55 lab and then Eddie wandering in the wilderness. And every time it switches to her, it's death. It's death. They got nothing going on.
Yeah, she was Sally in Sin City, a dame to kill for.
Yeah. And I guess she's Selina Kyle's sidekick in Dark Knight Rises.
Yeah, she's Jin in Dark Knight Rises.
Yeah, she's not called Holly, but right. I guess she's functionally the same as Holly Robinson.
Correct. Apparently Ted Lasso is where she's in a lot of, she's known for, I've never watched that show. But.
She's amazing in Fargo, but my God, she's so bad in that. Oh God, it was rough. So it's also worth noting out, so her character, I think, is named Dr. Teddy Payne.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's a gender swap of an early 90s Morbius and Venom villain. The early 90s Morbius and Venom villain is called Dr. Thaddeus Payne.
Oh, okay.
And his gimmick is he can't feel pain. Wouldn't you know it? She can apparently feel pain, our Juno Temple, our gender swap, Dr. Teddy Payne. But the way they reference her, the original male version of the character, is she has this really awful backstory of she was a teenager hanging out with her twin brother, but a lightning strike killed her twin brother, Dr. Thaddeus Payne, and it also killed and scarred up her arm. So one of her arms is dead.
Is that played in the movie at all?
No, they don't use it at all.
Oh, they don't use it at all.
It's just a weird, quirky fact about her is that her arm is scarred up from a lightning strike and doesn't seem to move.
Well, I mean, was the original idea that the symbiote would then, like, heal her?
You would think, or at least it would, like, give her mobility in the arm. But they don't have time for that. That's not touched on at all. Two other symbiotes are sort of relevant here.
Okay.
Do you remember Carnage's kid, Toxin? Toxin is in this movie, but he's imprisoned. Both the cop who's his host and the Toxin symbiote are also not identified by name, are imprisoned in Area 55. And he's just in Area 55, and he provides some exposition and some foreshadowing, and then he dies.
Just no real purpose, because I feel like that's the one I know the most because I knew him in the previous film.
There's been a couple Toxin mini.
I knew that one by name. I was wondering why you hadn't mentioned him yet, and I was like, wait, I thought that was one that was important.
Carnage is not mentioned at all, and then, Toxin is an exposition device and is killed.
Jeez.
Then you have the great actor Chiwetel Ejiofor plays the guy who's sort of supposed to be the villain. His name is General Rex Strickland, which you haven't read Donny Cates' Venom run, right?
No.
Donny Cates' Venom run is pretty good. In it, you find out that the U.S. government has had access to this for decades, and they use symbiote soldiers in Vietnam. And Rex Strickland is a character from that run who had a symbiote and used him in Vietnam. The symbiote's name was Tyrannosaurus. But in the movie, none of that applies. And in the movie, he's just a general who's sort of a jerk and sort of the villain. He's hunting Eddie Brock, and he's the tyrannical boss to the two lady scientists, Juno Temple and the other. Mm-hmm. But he also just doesn't wind up doing anything. So he's sort of the villain. He's second build, but he's also not the villain because he just winds up helping them attack the symbiote-eating monster in the final battle. So it's very strange.
So my understanding, Bob, is that Eddie Brock basically just ends up in this Area 55, and then
they capture him and bring him to it eventually. Most of the movie is him running in the wilderness or in Mexico or in Vegas, trying to get to New York, but never getting very far. But him running in the wilderness, and then eventually Strickland and his military goons capture Eddie Brock. Although, not before Eddie Brock kills a couple soldiers, which was interesting. All these different symbiotes that are mostly already there. Phage and Agony and Lasher were already there. And then there's a few other ones that are unnamed.
And no real interesting backstories, nothing just through there.
No, and no backstories. Even to the ones I'm naming don't have backstories. Yeah. I'm just using the name from the comic. And most of them are killed. I think Agony is the only one that survives.
Okay, like you said, they may take that one and set it for another film or something different.
There's two villains in this movie. One villain, well, really three. There's Strickland, played by Chiwetel Ejiofor, who's not really a villain. There's the symbiote-eating monster. And the person who sent the symbiote-eating monster, this is also from the Donny Cates Venom run, is Null. And he's the god of the symbiotes and the father of the symbiotes. Here, he's played by Andy Serkis, the guy who played Gollum. And the guy who also weirdly directed Venom 2. He's played by Andy Serkis, but he doesn't do anything. He sits in his evil dimension, and he sent the symbiote killer out to get Venom because for reasons that are too boring to explain, there's something about Venom that he could use to free himself from this hell dimension he's in.
Okay.
But he never gets Venom, and he never gets free. And so it's just Andy Serkis sitting around in the hell dimension, growling and monologuing in his Null costume. And nothing ever comes of it. It's to the point where they actually have a mid-credit scene where he's still in his hell dimension glowering after his scheme was defeated. And so it also seems like maybe they want to do another movie with Null. They don't actually use Null in it here. It's very strange.
Like Null's the Thanos of Sony.
Then they're going to have Infinity Symbiote. There's a whole family where there's a whole subplot where Eddie gets picked up by a hippie family where the father's this awful hippie who wants to see Area 51. And that's where some of the Storm Area 51 energy comes in. There's also just a lot of animal stuff. The Venom symbiote, as you might have picked up from the trailer, bonds with a lot of animals.
Like a horse. Yeah, I saw that.
A horse. Yeah. He also bonds with a frog at one point to escape the soldiers. Also to escape the soldiers, he basically turns into a mermaid.
My question, Bob, why does the symbiote, in the comics, we've seen it bond with other creatures too, right?
It's still bonded with Tom Hardy. It can, apparently can do short run multi-bonds.
Oh, like an extension or something of him. Okay. Yeah, it's not even, he left Eddie and then took over the horse.
And the climax is that Venom sacrifices himself to save Eddie and to stop the symbiote eater and to stop Noel. Obviously, they can bring Venom back if they want, but at the end, we're left with Agony and we're left with Noel. We could have the Agony versus Noel sequel, perhaps, if Sony wants to do that.
Well, you have Agony and Noel, and then in the MCU.
It seems like Tom Hardy is mostly done. It seems like he's willing to come back to do a Spider-Man crossover with Venom, but he doesn't really want to do any more just Venom movies.
He wants to be in the MCU. That's what he wants.
He does want to be in the MCU, just like Sydney Sweeney and what's-her-face, Kurt Russell's daughter from Madame Web. Mm-hmm. Well, Matt, I guess I did want to end by posing a question to you.
Sure, Bob.
Do you think that between Morbius, Madame Web, Venom 3, and the forthcoming Kraven, will this actually finally kill the live-action Sony Spider-Man universe?
Sony has done a really great job of video game wise. They created some amazing Spider-Man pieces and some amazing Spider-Man properties and its own lore and everything that goes along with it. I've been able to see what Sony could do if they actually had Spider-Man and not what they're trying to do here where they have all his supporting characters.
I would just say as a counterpoint, just because they can do it in the video games doesn't mean they could do it in film.
That is true. I will give you that. But they also, the other thing too, the animated piece Into the Spider-Verse, it was pretty great, right? People really liked that. I can't remember if you liked it or not. I know you saw it in theaters, but
I liked it. I was a little annoyed about the second one being so long and then ending on a cliffhanger for a movie that was years away.
Right. They're able to do it with animation. They're able to do it in video games. But you're right, the live action piece that just doesn't make the connection.
I
watched a really cool thing. There was a YouTube video where they went over all the 70s shows that dropped, the TV movies, The Incredible Hulk, Doctor Strange, Captain America, and Thor all had different, like, versions in the 70s.
Some of those, I think, were just TV movies.
They were.
Or maybe just even appearances in The Incredible
Correct.
Hulk.
Correct, yes.
Like, in the case of Thor.
They yeah. were, yes. But they were trying to make their own little MCU. It sucked by the time they had, even if they would all put it together. So then you got the whole thing where you're putting it all together here with the first time the MCU worked out with Robert Downey Jr. and all the Avengers, and it was great. But they're trying to do that with everything else. It doesn't have to be that way. Just give us good stories. There are good Venom stories. You even mentioned several Venom stories that I would have loved to see. I would like to see that thing, the whole thing with like the Vietnam Venom, them using the symbiotes for like super soldiers. That's cool.
This is where we just philosophically disagree, though. I don't think you can do interesting live action superhero stories for the most part. Like, to me, everything that's fun about comics like can't be captured in a live action film. And it just makes the concepts worse. Because every film has to be a 2 hour, a 2.5 hour thing. It has to introduce a certain amount of characters. It has to tease a certain other number of characters. It has to service the overall agenda for the MCU plan or the Sony Spider-Man universe plan. I just really don't think you can do good live action superhero movies. I'm sorry.
Do you think, Bob, it's because the live action piece animation, like Tom and Jerry, for instance, if you were going to make a live action Tom and Jerry film,
yeah,
it would look really
like
stupid.
Insane.
It would look really stupid. So it's the same idea with superheroes.
For a long time, that was true. The visuals on most of the 90s and the early aughts look so bad. And the 70s shows you're talking about look so bad. But they mostly overcome that. To me, the ideal format for Tom and Jerry is a 10-minute cartoon or an 8-minute cartoon.
Right.
You can tell a certain amount of stories in that. You can do a certain amount of gags. You can have, in this episode, Tom and Jerry are in Buenos Aires. Oh, in this episode, Jerry's high, right? You could do a lot of little funny things that tweak the formula. If you just had to do a 2-hour Tom and Jerry movie, that would probably suck.
And it did suck. So you're absolutely right.
Whereas superheroes work best, I think, when you get 12 issues a year, mm-hmm. and some of those issues are a part of larger stories, some of them are just one-off issues where there's character development or you establish relationships. Some have funny gimmicks. Oh, this is a silent issue, or this is told from the perspective of a side character. And you just can't do that in live action. They always have to be stupid, epic stories they always have to serve the ongoing plan for the universe. And I just don't think, to me, everything that's cool about superheroes comes from how they exist in the medium of comic books. And all of that is lost when you put it on screen.
Well said. Well said, Bob.
Well, Matt, I will say I probably should have led with this, but I got so distracted with the trivia of Venom 3. But this actually is a fun movie. It's not really much worse than Venom 1 or 2. On a certain level, it's really bad. On another level, it is fun. As a whole, more enjoyable by far than Morbius or Madame Web, and doesn't deserve to be put quite in the same category. On another level, the scenes with Juno Temple are deeply painful. And again, she's amazing in Fargo, so it's not her fault, but it's just deeply painful. So I'm not saying don't watch it. I'm saying just if you do watch it, know that it's bad and that a lot of the choices are inexplicable, and you kind of have to just watch it to enjoy the inexplicability of it.
That's right, Bob. Watch it for its mind-numbing excitement is what, entertainment is what you're saying.
Well, Matt, I think Kraven drops next month. And you know I'm going to see that.
I know you're going to see Kraven, Bob. And I hope you've set your expectations really high so you could be super disappointed.
I will say, even Madame Web, which is one of the single worst experiences of my life, it's fascinating, man. All these Sony Spider-Man live-action movies, they're terrible. But to me, they're so much more interesting than the MCU or the DCU stuff.
Bob's just eating up these Sony live-action superheroes.
I am. It's just me, brother. It's just me. Well, my good friend, my movie wife, we went to see Venom 3 together. I did not drag her to Madame Web. I won't be able to drag her to Kraven because she'll be out of town. I inflicted Morbius on multiple friends, nearly 10 people over to have dinner and watch.
Whew, that's... Jeez. What a disappointment.
All right, listeners, there's nothing to say. We probably will do a Kraven episode where I tell Matt about Kraven. This is an Uncanny Tracks. Bob reports back on the wars. Bob comes back from Venom 3, The Last Dance. That's Matt in the Southland. Everybody have a good evening.
Thanks for listening.